Chapter 18. I speak it with regret. I can see but two governments at this day which fulfill the mission that Providence has confided to them. They are the two colossi at the end of the world, one at the extremity of the old world, the other at the extremity of the new. Whilst our old European center is as a volcano, consuming itself in its crater, the two nations of the East and the West march without hesitation towards perfection, the one under the will of a single individual, the other under liberty. Providence has confided to the United States of North America the task of peopling and civilizing that immense territory which stretches from the Atlantic to the South Sea, and from the North Pole to the equator. The government, which is only a simple administration, has only hitherto been called upon to put in practice the old adage, laissez faire, laissez passer, in order to favor that irresistible instinct which pushes the people of America to the West. In Russia it is to the imperial dynasty that is owing all the vast progress which, in a century and a half, has rescued that empire from barbarism. The imperial power must contend against all the ancient prejudices of our old Europe. It must centralize, as far as possible, all the powers of the state in the hands of one person, in order to destroy the abuses which the feudal and communal franchises have served to perpetuate. The last alone can hope to receive from it the improvements which it expects. But thou, France of Henry IV, of Louis IV, of Carnot, of Napoleon, thou, who wert always for the west of Europe the source of progress, who possessest in thyself the two great pillars of empire, the genius for the arts of peace, and the genius of war, hast thou no further mission to fulfill? Wilt thou never cease to waste thy force and energies in intestine struggles? No, such cannot be thy destiny. The day will soon come when, to govern thee, it will be necessary to understand that thy part is to place in all treaties thy sword of Brennus on the side of civilization. These are the conclusions of the prince's remarks upon governments in general, and it must be supposed that the reader is very little wiser at the end than at the beginning. But two governments in the world fulfill their mission. The one government, which is no government, the other, which is a despotism. The duty of France is in all treaties to place her sword of Brennus in the scale of civilization. Without quarreling with the somewhat confused language of the latter proposition, may we ask what, in heaven's name, is the meaning of all the three? What is this épée de Brennus? And how is France to use it? Where is the great source of political truth, from which, flowing pure, we trace American republicanism in one stream, Russian despotism in another? Vastly prosperous is the great republic, if you will. If dollars and cents constitute happiness, there is plenty for all. But can anyone, who has read of the American doings in the late frontier troubles, and the daily disputes on the slave question, praise the government of the states? A government which dares not punish homicide or arson performed before its very eyes, and which the pirates of Texas and the pirates of Canada can brave at their will. There is no government, but a prosperous anarchy, as the prince's other favorite government is a prosperous slavery. What, then, is to be the épée de Brennus government? Is it to be a mixture of the two? Society, writes the prince, axiomatically, contains in itself two principles, the one of progress and immortality, the other of disease and disorganization. No doubt, and as the one tends towards liberty, so the other is only to be cured by order. And then, with a singular felicity, Prince Louis picks us out a couple of governments, in one of which the common regulating power is as notoriously too weak as it is in the other too strong, and talks in rapturous terms of the manner in which they fulfill their providential mission. From these considerations on things in general, the prince conducts us to Napoleon in particular, and enters largely into a discussion of the merits of the imperial system. Our author speaks of the emperor's advent in the following grandiose way. Napoleon, on arriving at the public stage, saw that his part was to be the testamentary executor of the revolution. The destructive fire of parties was extinct, and when the revolution, dying, but not vanquished, delegated to Napoleon the accomplishment of her last will, she said to him, "Establish upon solid basis the principal result of my efforts. Unite divided Frenchmen. Defeat feudal Europe, that is leagued against me. Cicatrize my wounds. Enlighten the nations. Execute that in width, which I have had to perform in depth. Be for Europe what I have been for France. And, even if you must water the tree of civilization with your blood, if you must see your projects misunderstood, and your sons without a country, wandering over the face of the earth, never abandon the sacred cause of the French people. Ensure its triumph by all the means which genius can discover and humanity approve." This grand mission Napoleon performed to the end. His task was difficult. He had to place upon new principles a society still boiling with hatred and revenge, and to use, for building up, the same instruments which had been employed for pulling down. The common lot of every new truth that arises is to wound, rather than to convince, rather than to gain proselytes, to awaken fear. For, oppressed as it long has been, it rushes forward with additional force. Having to encounter obstacles, it is compelled to combat them and overthrow them, until, at length, comprehended and adopted by the generality, it becomes the basis of new social order. Liberty will follow the same march as the Christian religion. Armed with death from the ancient society of Rome, it for a long while excited the hatred and fear of the people. At last, by force of martyrdoms and persecutions, the religion of Christ penetrated into the conscience and the soul. It soon had kings and armies at its orders, and Constantine and Charlemagne bore it triumphant throughout Europe. Religion then laid down her arms of war. It laid open to all the principles of peace and order which it contained. It became the prop of government, as it was the organizing element of society. Thus will it be with liberty. In 1793 it frightened people and sovereigns alike. Then, having clothed itself in a milder garb, it insinuated itself everywhere in the train of our battalions. In 1815 all parties adopted its flag, and armed themselves with its moral force, covered themselves with its colors. The adoption was not sincere, and liberty was soon obliged to reassume its warlike accoutrements. With the contest their fears returned. Let us hope that they will soon cease, and that liberty will soon resume her peaceful standards, to quit them no more. The Emperor Napoleon contributed more than anyone else towards accelerating the reign of liberty, by saving the moral influence of the revolution, and diminishing the fears which it imposed. Without the consulate and the empire, the revolution would have been only a grand drama, leaving grand revolutions but no traces. The revolution would have been drowned in the counter-revolution. The contrary, however, was the case. Napoleon rooted the revolution in France, and introduced, throughout Europe, the principal benefits of the crisis of 1789. To use his own words, he purified the revolution. He confirmed kings, and ennobled people. He purified the revolution, in separating the truths which it contained from the passions that, during its delirium, disfigured it. He ennobled the people in giving them the consciousness of their force, and those institutions which raise men in their own eyes. The emperor may be considered as the messiah of the new ideas. For and we must confess it, in the moments immediately succeeding a social revolution, it is not so essential to put rigidly into practice all the propositions resulting from the new theory, but to become master of the regenerative genius, to identify oneself with the sentiments of the people, and boldly to direct them towards the desired point. To accomplish such a task, your fiber should respond to that of the people, as the emperor said. You should feel like it, your interests should be so intimately raised with its own, that you should vanquish or fall together. Let us take breath after these big phrases, grand round figures of speech, which, when put together, amount like certain other combinations of round figures to exactly zero. We shall not stop to argue the merits and demerits of Prince Louis's notable comparison between the Christian religion and the imperial revolutionary system. There are many blunders in the above extract as we read it. Blundering metaphors, blundering arguments, and blundering assertions. But this is surely the grandest blunder of all, and one wonders at the blindness of the legislator and historian who can advance such a parallel. And what are we to say of the legacy of the dying revolution to Napoleon? Revolutions do not die, and, on their deathbeds, making fine speeches, hand over their property to young officers of artillery. We have all read the history of his rise. The Constitution of the year 3 was carried. Old men of the mountain, disguised royalists, Paris sections, Petit Cobourg, above all, with his money bags, thought that here was a fine opportunity for a revolt, and opposed the new constitution in arms. The new constitution had knowledge of a young officer who would not hesitate to defend its cause, and who effectually beat the majority. The tale may be found in every account of the revolution, and the rest of his story need not be told. We know every step that he took. We know how, by doses of cannonballs promptly administered, he cured the fever of the sections, that fever which another camp physician, Menou, declined to prescribe for. We know how he abolished the Directory, and how the consulship came, and then the empire, and then the disgrace, exile, and lonely death. Has not all this been written by historians in all tongues, by memoir writing pages, chamberlains, marshals, lackeys, secretaries, contemporaries, and ladies of honor? Not a word of miracle is there in all this narration, not a word of celestial missions, or political messiahs. From Napoleon's rise to his fall, the bayonet marches alongside of him. Now he points it at the tails of the scampering 500. Now he charges with it across the bloody planks of Arcola. Now he flies before it over the fatal plain of Waterloo. Unwilling, however, as he may be, to grant that there are any spots in the character of his hero's government, the prince is, nevertheless, obliged to allow that such existed, that the emperor's manner of rule was a little more abrupt and dictatorial than might possibly be agreeable. For this the prince has always an answer ready. It is the same poor one that Napoleon uttered a million of times to his companions in exile, the excuse of necessity. He would have been very liberal, but that the people were not fit for it, or that the cursed war prevented him, or any other reason why. His first duty, however, says his apologist, was to form a general union of Frenchmen, and he set about his plan in this wise. Let us not forget that all which Napoleon undertook, in order to create a general fusion, he performed without renouncing the principles of the revolution. He recalled the émigrés, without touching upon the law by which their goods had been confiscated and sold as public property. He re-established the Catholic religion at the same time that he proclaimed the liberty of conscience, and endowed equally the ministers of all sects. He caused himself to be consecrated by the sovereign pontiff, without conceding to the Pope's demand any of the liberties of the Gallican Church. He married a daughter of the Emperor of Austria, without abandoning any of the rights of France to the conquests he had made. He re-established noble titles, without attaching to them any privileges or prerogatives, and these titles were conferred on all ranks, on all services, on all professions. Under the empire all idea of caste was destroyed. No man ever thought of vaunting his pedigree, no man ever was asked how he was born, but what he had done. The first quality of a people which aspires to liberal government is respect to the law. Now, a law has no other power than lies in the interest which each citizen has to defend, or to contravene it. In order to make a people respect the law, it was necessary that it should be executed in the interest of all, and should consecrate the principle of equality in all its extension. It was necessary to restore the prestige with which the government had been formerly invested, and to make the principles of the revolution take root in the public manners. At the commencement of a new society, it is the legislator who makes or corrects the manners. Later, it is the manners which make the law, or preserve it from age to age intact. Some of these fusions are amusing. No man in the empire was asked how he was born, but what he had done. And, accordingly, as a man's actions were sufficient to illustrate him, the emperor took care to make a host of new title bearers, princes, dukes, barons, and what not, whose rank has descended to their children. He married a princess of Austria, but, for all that, did not abandon his conquests, perhaps not actually, but he abandoned his allies, and, eventually, his whole kingdom. Who does not recollect his answer to the Poles at the commencement of the Russian campaign? But for Napoleon's imperial father-in-law, Poland would have been a kingdom, and his race, perhaps, imperial still. Why was he to fetch this princess out of Austria to make heirs for his throne? Why did not the man of the people marry a girl of the people? Why must he have a pope to crown him, half a dozen kings for brothers, and a bevy of aides-de-camp dressed out like so many mountebanks from Astley's, with dukes' coronets, and grand blue velvet marshal's batons? We have repeatedly his words for it. He wanted to create an aristocracy, another acknowledgement on his part of the republican dilemma, another apology for the revolutionary blunder. To keep the republic within bounds, a despotism is necessary. To rally round the despotism, an aristocracy must be created. And for what have we been laboring all this while? For what have bastilles been battered down, and kings' heads hurled, as a gauge of battle, in the face of armed Europe? To have a Duke of Otranto instead of a Duke de la Tremouille, and Emperor Stork in place of King Log. Oh, lame conclusion! Is the blessed revolution which is prophesied for us in England only to end in establishing a Prince Fergus O'Connor, or a Cardinal Wade, or a Duke Daniel Whittle Harvey? Great as those patriots are, we love them better under their simple family names, and scorn titles and coronets. At present, in France, the delicate matter of titles seems to be better arranged. Any gentleman, since the revolution, being free to adopt anyone he may fix upon, and it appears that the crown no longer confers any patents of nobility, but contents itself with saying, as in the case of M. de Pontois, the other day, Le Roy Trouve Convenable, that you take the title of, and see, to execute the legacy of the revolution, then, to fulfill his providential mission, to keep his place, in other words, for the simplest are always the best, to keep his place, and to keep his government in decent order, the emperor was obliged to establish a military despotism, to re-establish honors and titles. It was necessary, as the prince confesses, to restore the old prestige of the government, in order to make the people respect it. And he adds a truth which one hardly would expect from him. The commencement of a new society, it is the legislator who makes and corrects the manners. Later, it is the manners which preserve the laws. Of course, and here is the great risk, that all revolutionizing people run, they must tend to despotism. They must personify themselves in a man, is the prince's phrase, and, according as is his temperament or disposition, according as he is a Cromwell, a Washington, or a Napoleon, the revolution becomes tyranny or freedom, prospers or falls. Somewhere in the St. Helena memorials, Napoleon reports a message of his to the Pope. "El the Pope," he says to an archbishop, "to remember that I have 600,000 armed Frenchmen, qui marcherunt avec moi, pour moi, et comme moi." And this is the legacy of the revolution, the advancement of freedom. 100 volumes of imperial special pleading will not avail against such a speech as this one, so insolent, and at the same time so humiliating, which gives unwittingly the whole of the emperor's progress, strength, and weakness. The 600,000 armed Frenchmen were used up, and the whole fabric falls. The 600,000 are reduced to 60,000, and straightway all the rest of the fine imperial scheme vanishes. The miserable Senate, so crawling and abject but now, becomes of a sudden endowed with a wondrous independence. The miserable sham nobles, sham empress, sham kings, dukes, princes, chamberlains, pack up their plumes and embroideries, pounce upon what money and plate they can lay their hands on, and when the allies appear before Paris, when for courage and manliness there is yet hope, when with fierce marches hastening, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.